Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. If you're a new listener, then welcome on board. I hope you enjoy it. If you've been listening for a while, then welcome back, and thanks for your continued support. For everything podcast related, you can find all you need over on our website, downtimepodcast.com. There's a link there to our shop where you can help us keep going, grab a t-shirt and support the cause. You can subscribe to the podcast. It's absolutely free and you'll get every episode delivered directly to your device as soon as it's available. You can subscribe to the newsletter there as well. Plenty of stuff to have a look at. All right, let's talk a little bit about this week's guest. Earlier in the year, I came across the story of Dustin Adams, a former Canadian World Cup downhiller who stood on the podium at World Cup Downhill alongside Steve Peat and now runs We Are One Composites, making high-quality carbon wheels and cam loops in Canada, instead of following the usual Far East supply route. I found his story of ups and downs really inspirational, so I got in touch. It turned out that Dustin was a fan of the podcast, and he kindly offered to send me some of their Agent 29er wheels for my new Kotick that I was building at the time. Now, I've been super impressed with the wheels, both from the quality side of things, but also from how they perform on the bike. So I thought it was time to get Dustin on the podcast, find out a bit more about his career and his story, and find out about how We Are One Composites works. If you like what Dustin and his team are doing and you're interested in getting yourself a set of We Are One's awesome carbon wheels, then Dustin has kindly offered to give a 15% discount off any DT Swiss 350 equipped wheels to all of our listeners. All you need to do is use the code DT350USA to get your money off. That's DT350USA. All right, there's some great stuff in here, including an exercise you can use to improve your reaction times that Dustin got from Formula One drivers. So without further ado, here's Dustin Adams. Dustin Adams, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, great to be here.
Good stuff. So let's, before we get into, I guess, what you're kind of more famous for these days, which is the We Are One Composites wheel side of things, let's wind the clock right back and go back to the beginning and tell us a little bit about how riding and how mountain biking came into your life in the first place.
Well, mountain bikes came into my life when I was about 14 years old. I met a really good friend whose dad was opening a bike shop at the time, and he made me kind of throw a leg over a bike. I was actually like a hockey player and a baseball player and a few other sports that we kind of tackled and just fell in love with it. Team sports wasn't really my thing, and I found that with a bike I could excel and push myself to the limit, and I really fell in love with it the very first second I kind of started on it, and ever since then it's been a part of my life.
Awesome. What can you remember what age you were when you first got on a mountain bike then?
I was 13. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a little bit late for compared to what's happening nowadays, but yeah, 13, yeah, it was a good time.
Sweet. What sort of riding were you doing then at that age? Was it just kind of exploring and getting out, or did you quite quickly get into the, you know, the jumping and the gravity related side of things?
I think we clunked about for a number of years. Cross country was our first kind of big kick into it. I was riding more distance on some trails around the neighborhood and in Kamloops, goofing around with our buddies. You know, we got into trials and the same bike did everything for us. So we had, trials kind of hangouts in the evening where we would goof around on a picnic table so you could hop on the top and hop off of it. And then we would go and, you know, session some silly steep section that everyone would crash on. And, you know, my good friend Tony would school everybody. And yeah, we just kind of pushed the limits of what we could do on the bikes. And the bikes at the time were pretty goofy. It was had a giant ring con that was fully rigid with cantilever brakes and full steel. I think the wing probably weighed about 40 pounds. And yeah, we just had fun more than anything.
Yeah, sounds pretty familiar to some of my growing up, to be fair.
Yeah.
How did that progress then from clunking around on big, heavy steel bikes with rim brakes to getting towards, you know, a bit of downhill racing? How did the racing part of it enter your life?
Well, my first foray into racing was actually cross country. We have a really cool local event that at the time was a big event. It was when racing was starting to pick up, and cross country in our area was the mainstay. Downhill really wasn't a big thing yet, and it's called the Stake Lake Stomp, and it was a 25-kilometer fire road loop that we would basically go out and hammer hard and have some fun. And I kind of threw my hat into the mix and gave it a shot and ended up eighth the first year, which everybody was really surprised because we were young. I think at the time we were 15 years old at the time and kind of caught a lot of people's eyes, and a lot of people started to talk about these other events we should start doing. And my friend's dad, like, who owned the bike shop, took us to a couple of the local BC Cup races, so our provincial race, and kind of grew in from there. And that's where we stayed racing cross country for the first 2 to 3 years of my life in the mountain bike world, and then found downhill soon after that when I was 17.
Nice. And were you fairly competitive? You know, were you up at the sharp end of that pretty quickly, or did it take a while to get there?
Yeah, it was a really easy transition, to be honest with you. It was I found, like I say, in team sports, I was always it's really bad. I was always kind of let down by my other competitors and compatriots. I wasn't really a good team player. So I would always try my hardest, and mountain biking allowed me to go as hard as I possibly wanted and could. And there was nothing holding me back. So I excelled quite quickly in the cross country side of things and ended up stacking up some pretty good results and winning some championships in both Canada and in our provincial races. And that was a pretty easy transition into downhill. I had a decent bike handling skill that came with a lot of time on the bike. It got better and better. And with the fitness from the cross country back in the day, the downhill courses weren't exactly what we would call gnarly downhill. And that kind of transitioned over to really good results immediately for my junior years and into the early pro years when courses started to progress.
Yeah. So did you find it fairly easy then to pick up some sponsorship?
Yeah, we had a local bike shop pick us up and give us a good deal on a Marin bike after our first purchased bike. We ended up getting a wholesale deal on that bike, and we raced that for a full season and getting really good results. I was the BC champion in both downhill and cross country that year, and was picked up by Norco Bicycles for my first junior year. And they gave me a full 2 bicycles for both downhill and cross country. And ever since that date, it was pretty straightforward going forward in the racing end.
Awesome. And you worked your way up to pretty high levels. Did I read right that you got pretty close to leaving the sport in, was it 2001? Were you almost at a job interview or something like that when Giant gave you a call?
Yeah, I'd been kind of, racing the national series, not really going anywhere, just kind of doing it for fun and doing the odd little film and event. And it was in the days of, free ride, early startup. So a lot of the industry was focused on that in our local area, and racing was kind of foddering out and was kind of hit and miss. And the parents were kind of telling me, you gotta get a real job and go out on your own. I had finished school and didn't have plans for university or anything like that. And was going to go work on the oil rigs because that's where all the money was in Canada at the time, at a young age without an education. So I was in one of the larger oil companies head offs about heading into an interview. And my team manager that had been sponsoring us through the Canadian Giant subsidiary was gave me a phone call, said, "Hey, listen, I've got an opportunity and you got a full ride in the US on the Giant team for 2002 and wanted to know if I was interested."
Awesome. That's a pretty exciting phone call. How did you react to that?
Yeah, it was pretty good. I mean, I was over the moon. I knew this was an opportunity for me to progress, and I had to take it really seriously. I had come off of a 16th place in Vail at the World Championships, and I was over the moon with that result, and I was kind of wondering where my life was going to go from there. And I didn't have any real good connections in the industry, and I was pretty much an unknown being from Canada. And I didn't mess around. I came back almost immediately. I hired a coach, trained my ass off all winter, and came into the 2002 series ready to stake a claim on the Norba series.
Awesome. What sort of stuff did you do in that off season? I read something where you mentioned reading up on how Formula One drivers train, like reaction times and things.
Yeah, I did pretty much everything I could under the sun. I mean, the day the internet was just coming around, so I was doing a lot of researching on reaction timing and how to improve your motor skills and your speed at what you process information and stuff like that. But yeah, mainly just a lot of fitness, getting myself into the game at a proper weight and a diet, and ensuring that all kind of downhill aspect wasn't just focused on riding the bike, but I wanted to bring back what I knew as successful as a regime for me, and that's get really good on the cross country bike again and gain a lot of that fitness coming into the downhill season.
Yeah. Okay. And can you remember any of the stuff you were doing for the reaction time side of things? Kind of be interesting to know.
Well, I read this book on how the Formula One drivers kind of you pick key points up, so you can sit anywhere. This is something that I did all the time. Anytime I was kind of sitting idle, not doing something, and you would look at certain points in a distance. You'd pick a far point, and then however many points in between you wanted to use, and you basically went between each points back and forth as fast as you can, but not moving to the next point until you actually had focused on the point you were looking at. Okay. And basically that just made your memory and your eyes and everything focus faster, so they said. And I just took it as it was gospel and believed in it, and it could have been complete false, but it worked for me, and it made my mindset and my mental state focus really good, and I took it as it was working. And like I said, I don't have any science behind it, but it worked for me at the time, and we kept doing it.
Yeah, it's cool. And you can even do it on a rest day, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, you can do it anywhere. Yeah, on the toilet or whatever.
Awesome. And then, so 2002, like, it panned out pretty good. Your best ever result with fourth place at Telluride World Cup.
Yeah. I mean, we came out of the gate. We were two Canadians in an American-driven sport in the U.S. To say that we were welcomed is an understatement. We were harshly shunned and definitely not taken in with open arms. There was a lot of top American riders that were supposed to get that ride. And a lot of the people in the industry were very vocal about that. And it made for a very unnerving kind of entry into the sport down there in the U.S. And I just kind of pushed it all aside and said, well, if that's what you think, then, stand aside and watch this. And my first race ended up, I believe it was fourth or third, stood on the podium, and then my first Norba big race on the team, and immediately shut up a lot of naysayers and non-believers, and just kept steaming ahead from there. I ended up standing on every podium except for one in that season, and ended up third overall, and did the World Cup and fourth and Telluride, and that was a really close race that I could have won, but never did. And yeah.
1.12 seconds off the win. I checked up. So Steve Peets at the win, yeah. Fabian Burrell, Cyril Lagneau, and then yourself. So that's a hell of a podium.
Yeah, it was a very tight race. It was really dry and dusty. I remember it was like it was yesterday. And there was the last corner coming into the finish line was this really blowing out janky left-handed berm, and I completely got stood up in it, and blew the whole thing right there. So it was a bit of a bummer, but it was best result ever, and I can't take that back, I guess. All right, you always wish you could do better, but the win kind of eluded me for sure.
And do you think the lack of a warm welcome from the US scene kind of helped fire you up even more and drove the results that season?
Definitely. I mean, it was a sense to prove my worth to the industry and to the sport, and to let people know that, there were fast riders in Canada, and we weren't just a bunch of free riders, and that we could compete on the world stage in downhill mountain biking.
Yeah, cool. And that's definitely, over time, that's definitely shifted. There's been some amazing Canadian riders coming through and still a strong pipeline. So it's pretty awesome.
Absolutely.
And then, And then that was followed up. You had a pretty bad training accident. Is that right? In the off season after that year?
Yeah, I ended up breaking. Actually, what happened that year now? I can't remember. I think I broke my scaphoid in training. No, actually, you know what? No, I came into 2003 fine. I had a good training season. And then actually it was 2003 in the season. We had an injury. We had had multiple things go wrong. We were in a massive accident in the team trailer where my teammate Terry Onis ended up breaking her leg, and everybody was really banged up from that accident. They wrote the vehicle off. It was really bad. And we, looking back at it all, I think we made some big mistakes on how everything was handled then. And, probably suffered a lot of PTSD from that. And, definitely the team wasn't, I guess we didn't have the support systems back in the day where, you know, we were forced into the next event, even though we just had this big event, this big, huge crash. And, you would think that, you know, you would take some time off and recoup and make sure the doctors, you know, looked after you and whatnot. But this was in Pennsylvania or Vermont at the time. And it was in between two rounds, and boom, you were at the top of the hill, you know, 2-3 days later, and pretty banged up and bruised. But we went at it. And so after Vermont, we went up to Mount St. Anne, had a tent there. And then I came back home and was hit by a car while training. Wow, so that's, I broke my scaphoid and badly injured my back, which was ultimately the demise of my career.
And was it something that you kind of couldn't return to competitive riding from, or was it just kind of enough was enough for you at that point?
I think it was a multitude of things. 2003 was a write-off after that. I didn't really do much of anything. I suffered pretty bad injury from that, worked the rest of 2003 and into the early season of 2004 to kind of get back into shape and get back in the swing of things. And I felt coming into 2004 that I was ready to battle, and ended up kind of slogging it out all season, had some ups and some downs, and still ended up third overall in the Norba series and got some podiums and did some good results at some World Cups. And that was contract year, and I thought, okay, well, the team sounded secure. Everything was in the right direction. And, you know, my team manager had mentioned that they were going to, you know, there was going to be some restructuring, but no one had said to me that, you know, my job was in jeopardy. I had by far the best results on the team in the downhill on the gravity side. And, I thought that, okay, well, you know, what team is going to fire their top rider? And not only that, what team is going to fire their top rider and not give them the audacity to kind of let them know that, hey, maybe you should start looking around because you got a life and a mortgage and a home now, and you have everything, going for you. But, it rolled out until about December 15th, 16th. I realized that this was not going to get done. And they gave me my last paycheck in the middle of December, end of December, and said, yeah, we're not looking to hire you back. Ooh. Without kind of any reason. So it was a really, really hard blow. And after everything I'd gone through, being hit by a car and injuries and everything, it was really tough. I went through hell. I went through absolute hell. I had set my life up to have an actual life in the industry where, you know, I had bought in a house, I had a mortgage, I had payments I needed to make. That late in the season, there was no teams just looking for people. The industry kind of was taking a bit of a dump at the time, and there wasn't a lot of people looking for riders. I had a chance to ride with, it was the Mad Cats team with Sam Hill at the time. And I would have taken, you know, close to a $70,000 US cut in pay.
Whoa.
Okay. Basically riding for nothing again, just getting travel and my bike and no bonus schedule, no nothing. The team was based around Sam, and that was cool, but there was no real room for me to do what I needed to do at the level that I wanted to do it at. And after looking around and seeing pretty much every door closed, I decided that was it. I was going to pull the pin, and I couldn't financially continue on. And it's at that time I was really badly mentally hurt by what happened. I went through about 2.5-3 years of really horrible times after that happened.
And then in 2009, this one kind of surprised me. You started your own kitchen worktop business.
It was 2007 actually. Gabe Fox, a real good friend of mine, tried to get me back on the horse and told me to get my shit together, and it didn't really fly. So I decided to go back into the trades and see if I can become a carpenter, and decided that it was a good time to open up my own business and continue to do my own thing, and started up kitchen countertop business.
Yeah, and that was pretty successful, right? You had that for, was it 4 or 5 years?
Let's see, 2009 to 2013, I sold it. Yeah, it was a good business. It started out with myself and one other guy and ended up having 25 employees and, doing like $2.5-3 million a year in business, and then ended up selling it to a person. Yeah, it was a good venture.
Yeah, but too much work to be able to get out on your bike.
Oh, I didn't ride a bike at all. After 2007, when Gabe tried to get me back, I put my bike in the garage and I sold every bike I had, and I didn't touch a bike for almost 6 years.
Wow. Okay. And so 2013 comes around. You've got children at this point, is that right?
Yeah, my first son was born in 2009.
Uh huh. That's it. Yeah. Was it two children by 2013? Is that right?
Yeah, two boys. Yeah. 2009, 2011. Yeah, Levi and Chance. Yeah.
Nice. And you decided to sell on the kitchen worktop business and get away from it for a bit and go traveling, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we decided that. it's a long story, but we had a really another bad. It just seemed like a bad time after bad time. After I was hit by the car, lost everything. The insurance company that we were the lady that hit me, we went through a rough time there, and a family friend ended up taking all of the money that we got from the insurance due to being hit by somebody else, like the insurance faults or whatever it is there, and so we lost all that money. Oh. And then we just decided that this was our chance to kind of take some money and enjoy life. So we took the whole family and we traveled from New Zealand and all around Southeast Asia for 8 months.
Amazing. And
seen the world. Yeah, it was really cool.
How old were the boys at this time?
They were 4 and 2. So yeah, they had a blast. It was, my oldest son remembers, the really interesting, cool parts, through, Indonesia and Thailand. We spent a lot of time in Thailand and Vietnam, and, yeah, it was a great time. I had nothing but a blast, and the kids will remember it, I hope, forever.
Amazing. That's really cool. Yeah, and kind of quite unusual, I guess, with young children. Not many people are kind of brave enough to do that, actually. Did you find it challenging with kids, or was it fine?
It was I would say it was better, and I felt safer. I don't know, even if you're the baddest guy in the world, I don't think you're going to mess with somebody when you see a kid, because that's, I think, near and dear to everybody's heart. So we had a fantastic time. Everybody was very helpful and accommodating, and people constantly asking to take pictures with our kids. They're both blonde, so they were like little deities in all those countries. And it was a really, really exciting time, and I would love to go back. I would highly recommend traveling through there with families, actually.
Awesome. Yeah, that's cool. And, a lot of people talk about going away or traveling for a bit to sort of find themselves, which is a bit of a nebulous term, I guess. But did you find it helped you kind of work out what it was you wanted to do next to get that space from the day job, effectively?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I buried myself, I buried myself in work to deal with a problem that I needed to kind of face head on. And that problem was that biking was meant to be a massive part of my life. And I needed it back in my life. And I came back from that trip and we sold our house in Kamloops and moved to Squamish with the full notion that I needed to get back in somehow. I needed to immerse myself in the community and find a good community that I could kind of grow some roots back into the industry.
And is that when Noble Wheels came part of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I came back from our trip and I had actually taken on a sales job with one of our stone suppliers that I used to buy product from. And the job provided me with a really healthy wage and some flexibility to move to Squamish. And I ended up stumbling across Noble Wheels via a customer of mine, believe it or not, who was a partner in the company. And he had mentioned that they were looking for a operations manager. And I met with the two owners at the time, with Trevor Howard and Ryan Kananoff. And we made a discussion and had a few discussions back and forth. And I told them that I wasn't really interested in just kind of coming on in a day job. If I'm going to do this, I wanted to do it as a part of the business. And that, you know, that was the only way that it would really work for me. And I ended up buying into the company and, taking it on full head.
Cool. And that was that the first point at which kind of carbon wheels started to feature in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at that time, it would have been 2015 mid 2015. I had no idea carbon wheels even existed. Not a clue at all. And I found out quickly that the industry was quite big and was growing fast, and there was a lot of players and a lot of different avenues to bring products to the market. And it was really exciting because it brought a lot of my manufacturing from the stone business and my riding capability and knowledge from my background. So it was really tying together into a really fantastic situation.
Awesome. Yeah. And being back in, you know, fully into the mountain bike scene and the mountain bike community, I guess must have been quite a nice place to be.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I was probably the happiest I'd been in a long time, for sure.
Cool. So when did you first get that little seed in your head where you started to think about doing something yourself and We Are One started to become something that you were considering?
Well, we were contracted out by our manufacturer, which was Light Bicycle at the time, to work for them to grow the North American market and bring that product to market as well, on top of what we were doing at Noble Wheels. And I had mentioned to Ryan and them that Ryan and Trevor, that after a few visits to the factory, that we should be doing this in North America. There was a lot of things that I seen in the manufacturing process that I scratched my head at. There were some QC things that I was not super firm on, and I knew that there could be improvements. And I think that the biggest struggle was not being able to convey the message clearly back and forth, and knowing that they had a very secure business there with something that was working, a model that was working for them, that the change didn't make much sense to them for a lot of the things that I put forth.
Okay.
And at that point, it was actually Interbike 2016. At Interbike, our relationship fizzled, and we had a pretty massive blowout. And I walked away from the table, and with full intentions that this was going to be my direction, and I was starting my own manufacturing company here.
Yeah, exciting times. So, yeah, tell us a little bit about kind of your vision for We Are One Composites, and yeah, like what have you set out to achieve, and how have you gone about it, I guess?
Yeah, it was, after Noble, it was, I had actually gone back to Asia and thought, okay, well, I can find a factory in Asia and I can do this better. I just need to find the right partner. So I spent 3 weeks in Asia traveling around all the factories from up north to down south to Taiwan, and ended up coming back on the plane thinking, kind of seeing what was happening over there, and lead times were getting larger. Demand was getting more on each factory. The factories were starting to become busy. You could see some of the QCs were even getting worse at some of the other factories I'd visited in previous past, and things were just getting messier and busier, and it looked like it was going to be even harder to do business there than I currently had thought. So on the plane ride back from China, I just decided, you know what, that I need to put down a business plan and a proposal to see what it would take to do exactly what I thought could be done. And that's manufacturing rims here in Canada. With my manufacturing business and background in the stone business, I understood what it took to make a raw good into a finished product and sell it to the market. I understood the systems that need to be in place to do that. The machinery it would take to make it happen. The only thing I wasn't, 110% on was the engineering side of carbon. I'd never, other than the times at the factory kind of messing around with the people on the floor, I'd never touched carbon fiber or put it into a mold, done any of the engineering at all. So there was a bit of an uphill battle there, which we needed to find and source. And we ended up landing with a really good engineer, a young engineer, Fraser Andrew. He came from the UK, he used to work at Rolls Royce and had some really good knowledge and engineering prowess that brought to the table. And that really kicked off how and when we began We Are One.
Fantastic. And so how do you go about designing a product like that? So you started off with your Agent wheel, is that right? Which is the kind of enduro, like in the middle of the range maybe?
Yeah. So basically from the beginning, it started out from what I seen as a manufacturing hiccup, and that's the process in Asia. So the process that you use there is heavily post-mold reliant. So that means that a lot of the rims come out flawed and faulty inside of the molding process and are sanded, doctored, painted, whatever you want to call it, to make it look good.
For people that aren't familiar with the way that carbon wheels are made, can you give us like a really quick rundown of the process and how that differs from what you're doing?
Yeah, so standard processes, they'll have a steel die mold that they cut in Asia that there are not a lot of different variations between that process right now. I mean, there's some that are doing some really wild stuff, and I'm not saying they're not good at doing it. I'm just saying it's a very, very similar model from one manufacturer to the other currently. Mm-hmm. So with a steel mold, what they do is they'll use that mold for the curing process and for the final shape of the process. And then they'll pre-mold it into an aluminum die, I guess. So they'll do all of the pre-mold. They'll get it up to kind of a rough shape a fairly rough shape. And then they'll put that pre-molded, pre-bladdered product into a steel mold, which they form fit and make sure everything kind of goes in as it should go. That's just on the outside, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then they'll button that mold up and put it into the press, which will inflate the bladder. They'll do all of the finished curing in there, mm-hmm. and then it'll come out. So that mold's getting consistently used throughout the day. And it's a bit of a weird situation where I wondered like, okay, well, how many could we get out of a steel mold? How true is that product? Fiber has a drift to it and it can move with inside the product. And I said, well, how accurate and how repeatable is this process without having any kind of known issues when you have a die mold that you're putting the layup all into? You're trusting that everything's been done in there isn't going to move once it hits the steel mold. And not only that, you have certain heights. So when you're talking about your rim package, when you're laying it up, you want to have, your rim, you say your rim lip area, you want to make sure the actual tire sits on the rim. You want to make sure that package is as tight as you can get it up to the top of the rim so that your fibers don't drift all over the place and you have big issues.
Yeah. So that fiber alignment is a few things, I guess. It's the geometry of the rim, the mm-hmm. the kind of stiffness characteristics of the rim, and also the structural, the strength of the rim ultimately. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's some key secrets in there as to how it's done to make sure that your fibers are elongated and aren't bunched, and are doing 100% of the work that you intend for them to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big thing that with our process that we are able to achieve is we lay up all of our product inside of the mold that we actually use for curing. We have height allocations for where we're going to put each fiber. Everything is actually specifically put where it should be over and over and over again. And that's how we achieve a repeatability of plus or minus 2 grams on all of our products. And wow, where China is plus or minus 15, sometimes 20 grams. And
yeah,
if you know anything about the layup and the design, 15 grams could mean that you take a complete double layer of fiber out of one of our products, which would completely ruin exactly what we're trying to achieve. So plus or minus 15 is a massive variation that we would never even think would be like, if we wanted to work that tolerance, our product would be garbage.
Right. Okay. Interesting. And to be able to work to a tolerance that big, what are they having to sacrifice? Is it the quality of the finish? Is it, you know, the repeatability of the ride characteristics? Is it the ultimate strength of the product?
It's all of those. At the end of the day, it's repeatability tags almost everything that you've just said. Okay. If you can't repeat the process over and over again and nail a weight, it's either one, it's been sanded off because of imperfections and then filled, or it's been a layer has been left out. Your layers are not accurately cut. Your layers have bunched and you've got, you know, a massive loss of resin. There's a multitude of things that end up causing repeatability issues, but in the end the product suffers from one rim to the next, and that's where you have, you know, a big problem is that one company can produce a bunch of rims coming out of Asia, but one rim is not going to be the same as the other when you have that much of a variance.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So yeah, the tolerances that you're achieving are much, much tighter than that version of the supply chain.
Yeah. I think it's the tolerance is a big, is the crown that we wear, but the whole reason we're able to achieve that is because of the process. So knowing that we have, you know, a CNC cutter that cuts fiber accurately, and then where each package goes into the rim and how it goes into the rim, that's where we're able to achieve the exacting ride characteristics from one rim to the next, as well as strength and so on and so forth.
Awesome. So yeah, talk to us a little bit about the ride characteristics. So there's a lot of talk around carbon wheels and even carbon bikes, I guess, in, you know, getting the stiffness right, because there's benefits of stiffness, but there's also elements that are unpleasant. You know, riding a wheel that's bouncing off everything and is kind of harsh is not great. Mm-hmm. How would you describe what it is you've tried to achieve with your products?
Well, ride quality is always the first thing that we look for when we're designing rims. It's what we look for when we design the agent. You need to understand that how the fiber is oriented within the rim, within your layup process, and your layup package, directly impacts how stiff the rim is going to be, both laterally and radially. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately is going to give you, you know, a good or a bad ride feel. But the one thing you're always battling is impact strength and overall strength of the product, as well as weight. So generally, on a very general term, and this isn't 100% flawless, but stiffness increases. So the stiffer a rim, generally a very rough rule of thumb, your strength will also be better. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of some companies have focused and are now learning how to go away from it. And what we've worked on is, okay, can we change orientation? Can we add more woven fiber? Can we add more other kinds of fiber to achieve everything and get, you know, the best case result at the end, where the rims aren't radially insanely stiff. You have a really good ride feel, but you keep that lateral stiffness so that the wheels track better, without being a massive ballooned out weight. So it's a bunch of key targets you're trying to hit, and to hit them optimally, it's a very big challenge. And, we're working on a few things right now where we're learning that shape isn't as dramatic of a player as the actual orientation of the fiber is and stuff like that. So there's some cool stuff that, that we've been learning throughout the last year and a half. And yeah, we've done well with the agent the way we've designed it. You'll notice that our rims are definitely not radially stiff, but they do hold a real good lateral line. And the impact resistance, I would be very confident to say that we have one of the strongest rims on the market without a doubt right now.
Yeah, I've been riding a set of the agents for, I don't know, 8 or 10 weeks now. And I've had a couple of those moments where you get that horrific feeling through the back end of the bike and you kind of immediately want to pull off the trail and check what you've done to it. And literally not even a mark. I've got a couple of little scuffs from bouncing through rocks and stuff, but no marks from smashing through tires and hitting rocks. And yeah,
no, it's good. Yeah, good to hear.
Super impressive.
I think a lot of our customers have come back and have said much the same to us, that they've been amazed at how strong the rim is and what it's taken. And that's one of the reasons we ended up giving our product a lifetime warranty. And, you know, with confidence knowing that we can back it. And we've come to the market with a product for the first year that, that speaks to that level.
Yeah. Awesome. And I'm assuming that it, with the supply chain that you're using and not working in the Far East, are you getting better quality, fiber products as well? And does that help, or, you know, your quest for strength and all of this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I think we have two suppliers that we work with. One that we're just starting to test, just because we want to pit them against each other and see if this exact thing we're talking about right now is the case. Is the fiber much better at one supplier than the other, and see what's stronger or weaker. But right now, I would say that being sourced and manufactured here, is definitely, we're going to get a genuine product. When we get our product and we know what the other people are using, we know that this company is the company that says is making the fiber and the quality is up to spec. And they do a lot of aerospace in that building as well. So we know that the quality is high, if you're able to provide those kinds of products. So yeah, definitely happy to be buying our products here in North America.
Yeah, fantastic. And how do you go about achieving the kind of the quality of the finish that you guys are putting out? Because the rims are absolutely stunning, not just on the outside, but on the inside as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest, the one hurdle we needed to get over when we started this whole company was, we needed to kill the after mold labor that needed to be done to make a rim sellable. And if we weren't able to achieve that, there's no way that we could have got off the ground, because, you know, in China, 90% of the labor is actually done post mold. So a lot of sanding out flaws and heavily painting products and filling in pits and voids to make a product look good, which in turn weakens the fibers and sometimes even sands through some of the layers, which are structural layers, which makes a rim completely weak. So all of that was the big reason why we started VR1 was, I believe firmly that you could make a product sellable out of the mold. And in turn, that's going to make a stronger product because it hasn't been messed with at all. And it has to look good. So we sourced out and worked really, really hard at our bladder process, the bladder material, the resin structure, the mold structure, the type of molds we used. A lot of those things came into play, and at the end, we ended up being able to achieve a sellable product right out of the mold. We just need to knock off the resin parting lines where the molds come together, and the flash that comes off of that, drill our holes, and the product is ready for sale. So that was a big feat, and we're really proud of what we've achieved.
Yeah, and you have a pretty stringent quality control process. Is that right? 12 point quality check on the product?
Yeah, it goes through, I believe, 12. You're going to put me on the spot here. So we QC the fiber when it comes in. It's QC'd for weight before it goes into the mold. The molds are QC'd to ensure that they're up to par so that the product comes out the same every time. the rim is laid up into the rim, the mold, sorry, and it's QC'd for who made the rim. The serial number goes on. When it comes out, it's QC'd visually for any imperfections or visual imperfections. Sometimes we end up getting, you know, the odd little visual imperfection where, you know, a piece of a flash or something didn't get removed from a mold perfectly and ends up in the rim, and the rim is structurally fine, but we have this visual defect that we feel is unable to be sold. So we usually use those for team rims. And then we're cleaned and weighed. And we have ladder removal, drilling, another QC checkpoint for the product actually passing the grade. And then it goes up into the wheel build room. And before it gets built into a wheel, where we visually check the rims again before we assemble it into an asset for the customer.
And you've been doing custom stickers as well. Has that been popular?
Yeah, it has. I mean, I've learned Illustrator very, very quick and dirty by myself. Nice. So I've become an industrial designer of sorts. Not to say that I'm happy or proud of what I've done, but I've learned and I'm trying my best. But yeah, I think we have a very unique look. We're not out there to be loud and proud and put three decals on our rims and try to emulate a famous company. But you know, we want to have our own unique look, and we decided that the dual chevrons has a really unique characteristic, and you can definitely point a set of our wheels out in motion or on the ground. And every time we do, everyone here in the company gets a little giddy and is extremely excited to see people riding our product.
Awesome. Yeah, they look good. So what's been the toughest part of getting this up and running then? Because it's a hell of a piece of work that you've gone through there. That's setting up a supply chain in Canada, building the company, and then getting product out there and, you know, doing the marketing side of things. What's been the hardest part of it all?
Ensuring my wife that everything's going to be okay. it's been a heck of a trial and a road so far. I mean, we're a year and a half, a year and three quarters now into We Are One. I leveraged, risked, and put every waking penny I had into this company. So it's been a real stressful venture for us. It's not easy starting up a company. It took a lot of time and energy to get it, the engineering done. That was our hardest initial stage, was, you know, milling the molds and getting everything in place, proving our concept, taking our concept and then making the actual wheel mold and ensuring that the molds were tight tolerance and everything was done to par and confirming that the actual tolerances were good and everything was going to come out good out of the mold. And then learning the layup, that was a solid 6 months of testing and breaking product and ensuring that everything was where we should be. And then from there, it was great. We launched, you know, our product on June 1st of 2017 with high hopes, and realized very, very quickly that without marketing and without anyone knowing who the heck you are, your company's going to go nowhere. So, we were disappointed extremely for the first month that people weren't jumping off the buildings to buy our products, and we had to kind of learn how the powers that be nowadays in our industry can be great assets to getting our name out there and delivering the product that which we knew was fantastic, and we wanted the people to believe that the people putting out the message on our behalf did test the product and did believe in the product and weren't bought off, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think we've done a good job, and we've maintained our position this year. We hope that we can start marketing and growing our message into next year, that so that people are really well aware of what we're up to.
Cool. And what's been the highlight then so far?
The highlight for me was going to an enduro round in Chilliwack this year, a Canadian National Enduro round, which we sponsor, and showing up there unannounced and just kind of, I was riding the race and looking around and seeing how many people in British Columbia and in the Alberta and then Washington were riding our product. It was so elating to see that not only did we connect with people, but we connect with a really core audience of riders that were beating the hell out of our wheels in racing and riding, and some of the top guys that I didn't even know we sold wheels to that bought through some of our dealers. You know, I was just over the moon to see people actually believing in what we were doing and believing in the product and supporting the brand. It was really awesome to see.
Yeah, it's very cool. Very cool indeed. So where's it heading next? Have you got grand plans for the future?
Yeah, absolutely. We're working on other products currently. We're coming to market with that in 2019. We're doing 2019, we'll be doing some other work on some new rims and revamping some current layups that we have. And late 2019 is when we are we're finally going to put our first mold into the CNC and start working on a bicycle.
Interesting. Okay. Wow. I wasn't expecting that. Impressive.
Yeah, it's been a dream of mine. I don't know. I can't say for sure if it's going to get to market and it's going to be a thing, but I firmly believe that we can manufacture bicycles here, do a good job of it in Canada on a scale that makes sense for a company like us. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to be a venture that will see us become a Trek or a Specialized, but I think that we can do a fantastic job of creating a really solid bike. Now that bikes have become basically one bike for everything, I think that this is the perfect time to really put our foot down and enter that market. And I think by 2020, that's when we expect to have something to show.
Cool. So yeah, prototypes floating around early 2020 then, if all goes to plan.
To late 19, I'm hoping prototypes will be ready. Awesome. Yeah. So maybe you'll see something late 19, but it all depends on how busy a year it gets around here. I mean, we had a massive amount of growth this year. We were struck with having to double production in the busy part of this year, which was a lot of stress and strain on everyone around here. And we managed to achieve that and keep up with production. And it's really, really difficult when you're not just selling this product, but you're making this product to throw all of those metrics in. And when you're growing and doubling in size during a busy season, it's a lot of stress and strain, but we've achieved that. And I think we've got to a point now where we can grow another 30% to 40% this year, which we planned out, and achieve a fairly good turnaround time and keeping our customers happy and maintaining our quality. And that'll give us some time in engineering to really move forward with a lot of these other projects we've been thinking about.
Yeah. Well, you've got to be doing something, right? If you've got growth like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I can't thank everyone enough that supported our brand and supported our message and the products that we're putting out there. I mean, we've done our absolute best to get a product underneath people that they're going to be happy with. And I think the people that have jumped on board have been over the moon on the quality of the product and the way that it's handled the beating they've been able to give it. And yeah, we want to continue moving that message forward and picking up customers along the way organically and ensuring that they have a good experience with our company and support them through any issues they might have down the road. And just continue to grow the brand at a rate that makes sense for us and means a lot to us so that we can keep that message high.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time for today, but we've got a few questions that we ask pretty much all our guests. So we'll hit you up with those if that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good stuff. So the first one, if you had, and I've done this, I think this is about right, $200 Canadian for our listeners to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend that money on?
Oof.
Not a lot of money.
It's tough nowadays because, I mean, all the bikes coming off the showroom floor, I mean, they have almost everything. $200. If it didn't come with a dropper, I would say a dropper. After that, I would say tires.
Okay. And then do you have a go-to tire or pair of tires?
I've been really happy with some of the newer versions of the Continentals. Obviously Maxxis is always near and dear to my heart. I really like those and have always had good luck with the Minions, the DHF.
Yeah.
The new tire that Menara came out with there is pretty impressive as well.
Okay. And what kind of pressures do you go pretty low when you own the rim company?
I'm really light on a bike. Even I'm 200 pounds. I'm not really a hard on the wheel or hard on the rim guy. I'm very kind of light as a feather on a bike. Uh-huh. And, I run 21 in the front to, 23 to 24 in the rear.
Okay.
Pretty much on all of our models.
Yeah.
And no issues at all. Haven't broken one of our rims myself.
Okay, cool. All righty. Question number two. If you could wind back the clock and have a sit down with yourself, age 16, given everything that you know now, what advice would you give him?
There's a few things I'd say. Keep your friends close and your enemies even closer.
Okay.
And shut your mouth and listen a little bit more. And make sure you network, because a network is stronger than a result.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, especially in some of the size of the mountain bike community, it's not really big. So the more people you know, the better it is, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And then the final question, if you could have a coaching day with anyone, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
That's a good one.
You can have more than one if you want.
Yeah, there's a few. I'd like to ride with Steve Pete, because I always had this fascination with how he was able to carry speed pretty much everywhere at all times, and I've always wanted to ride with him to kind of figure that out. He's always kind of blowing my mind there. I think that the guy could hop on a track, and if it was a one-shot deal, you had no pre-run, no nothing, I'd be surprised if he wouldn't win every race. Mm-hmm. I'd really like to ride with Brendan Semenuk.
Yeah.
Just to see, like, how in God's name do you make riding look so good?
Yeah.
It's just amazing to watch. And Connor Fearon, I'd like to learn how he drifts that bike about underneath him like it was nothing and keep it in control all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Some very stylish riders there. A good range. Good stuff. All right. Well, we wish you all the best in the future and super excited to see more of your products and to see a bike at some point in the near future. But if people want to check out what you're doing, what's the best place to find you guys?
Yeah, our website is probably the easiest. It's weareonecomposites.com. It has kind of a list of everything that we offer and gets you to all of our appropriate channels on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube.
Awesome. Well, we'll stick a link to that in the show notes so that people can find it. It'll be over on our website. But yeah, all the best.
Yeah, thank you very much, and cheers for having me on.
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much. All right, that's it for our episode with Dustin Adams. If you enjoyed it and you're interested in getting yourself a set of We Are One's awesome carbon wheels, then all you need to do is use the code DT350USA to get 15% off any wheels equipped with DT Swiss 350 hubs. All right, we're going to have another great episode for you coming up real soon, but until then, get out and ride.